Welcome to True Crime in the Low Country, where we explore the darkest corners of the region's criminal history. Join host Frank Santarella and co-hosts Crime and Cask, Jim Cask, and Elaine Greenwood of Superwoke News as they dissect the chilling details of the Murdaugh murder trial, a case that has gripped the nation and exposed years of fraud, deception, and tragedy. It's True Crime in the Low Country, and the truth is just around the corner.
You're listening to WVFF 97.7 LPFM, broadcasting from Cottageville, South Carolina, and this is a feature presentation with Elaine Greenwood of Superwoke News, who can be found on X. But first, we have Jim Cask of Crime and Cask, and he's on CC News Network. And Jim, tell us what your URL is if we want to get there.
Oh, you go to crimeandcask.com, or you can go to ccnewsnetwork.com.
And Elaine, where can we find you 24/7? Because I know you're there 24/7.
Don't find me. I don't want to be found. Isn't that how you'll say that on the radio?
Oh, I don't want to be found either.
I'll hide, you hide. Let's just push Jim out there.
Yeah.
I'm on X, and basically, I just want to go with X. I'm so excited about the possibilities and the audience you can reach, so I'm going to stay on X. But I was on YouTube until YouTube pulled the plug on my channel, which hurts, let me tell you. And then I was on Rumble for a while, but Rumble just doesn't work for me, and it didn't work for my audience, so I like X. I really do.
Well,
and I'm really excited about doing this much, much more. I know Jim is ready and raring to go with, Jim, tell us what's going on in your life, because I know you're about to break some important stories, especially with John P. Miller and a lawsuit filed by Jane Doe number one on February 25th, so just, you know, a few days ago. Tell us every little thing that's fit to the pinch.
Oh boy. Well, let's start with some positive news first, and then we'll go into John Paul Miller. But some positive news is last Saturday, I attended a very peaceful protest in Lawrence, South Carolina. And I was there with Erica Moses. So much of her family was there. Friends were there. There was 80 people that showed up. The Clinton Chronicle was there. It's a local newspaper. Fox Carolina out of Greenville was there and did a story on it. And it was the tragic death of Caden Moses, the 14-year-old boy that Eric and I started this journey back in, I think it was July or August of this year, where no one had covered it. There was just an obituary of his death. And so there's a lot going on there. So there was a peaceful protest, and it was a protest that was for justice for Caden. And what they're hoping is that the 8th solicitor, circuit solicitor out of Lawrence County, David Strumbo, files charges against the
tell us, who, Jim, tell us where this where this protest occurred. I'm sure it didn't happen in the middle of the woods around the bonfire. Where did it actually?
We did it at the Lawrence County Courthouse, of all places, because that's where justice will be served for Caden Moses.
Okay, so, good. Thank you.
Very peaceful. So we'll see where that goes.
When was Caden murdered? Was it December 31st of 2023? He's 14 years old, sitting in his house.
Yes, yeah, so, well, it was December 30th, 2023. So that's just a little over a year ago. And no one has been arrested or indicted for his murder.
Is that because there are so many suspects? There are like hundreds and hundreds, and they just can't winnow through them?
No, I will say this, and I can say this publicly because she said it herself publicly on her page. Lori Murray, many people know her as Lawyer Lori on TikTok, and she helped represent Erica and the family when they met with the they met with SLED, they met with the solicitor's office, and they met with the medical examiner. And according to Lori, the whole team from the state said they agreed that they believe that the person that was with, he's a minor, but there's a person that was with Caden, did pull the trigger. And they're trying to figure out how, when, all the things that go into filing a lawsuit, or not a lawsuit, but a
criminal. So it's not that they don't know who a very likely suspect is. It's that he's a minor, and that complicates things. And Sled seems to have said, well, it's complicated, it might be tough, and so we just quit. And they just sort of let it go. Is that kind of a fair assessment?
Kind of. I mean, that, yeah, the case was closed. And it technically, it still is closed, but I think they're trying to figure out how to charge him. So yeah. Lori said in her post that, you know, that it should go to family court because he's a minor and let a judge decide this.
Yes.
Yeah. Show him the evidence. And I've said publicly that there's more evidence here than there was to convict Alec Murdoch. And there's no lie about that. There's more evidence here. So I think there's enough evidence to do it. I feel sorry for Erica and her family. I feel sorry for the kid and his family. He did an adult thing. Maybe they cut it up to adult court. I don't know. But it's not good for anybody all around, clearly, especially the Moses family. So that was some good news. We'll keep you posted on what's going on there. I tell you, this John Paul Miller thing's kind of blowing up in the state of South Carolina when it comes to true crime.
Yes, it is. And you're at the, you got your hands on the stick of dynamite, or at least the match. No.
Well, I seem to have walked into a hornet's nest.
Hey, can I just throw something in there on this Kaylin Moses thing? This is one of the most difficult things that I've ever heard, you know, situationally. What I don't think that people realize is that, and again, I would really need to see the forensics and all the mechanics and what the firearm was and where the kids were supposedly positioned at the time of the firearm discharge. Firearms can discharge without somebody physically pulling the trigger. And I don't know, and not knowing, I have more questions than I have answers. And to assume there were two people in the room and one ended up dead from discharge of a firearm, that the other one pulled the trigger is an assumption.
That is not what's being assumed. There's a lot known. We know where Caden was. We know Caden's both hands were on the control of a video game he was playing online with his girlfriend at the time he was shot. And we know the trajectory of the bullet. We know the gun. They have the gun. It's not just as simple as, gee, two people were in the room and one's dead, the other one must have done it. Law enforcement knows, and Jim certainly knows, that there's very strong evidence. Like, that's what he meant when he said there's stronger evidence here leading us to an accurate understanding of who pulled the trigger than we have with Alec Murdoch. Although I would argue that that's a poor example, Jim, because I don't think Alec Murdoch killed Paul and Maggie. I think you and I, all three of us, have covered that ad nauseum. But in the second trial, I don't think he's going to be convicted. If the state decides to try to retry him, because I don't think they have the evidence.
Elaine, just what I'm saying is, without further investigation, we really can't make a supposition.
Yeah, well, so the kid said a lot of things. Eyewitness report said, you know, my fingerprints are all over the gun. I loaded the gun. He also said he unloaded the gun. But where he was sitting, according to the girlfriends who were on a video call with him prior to that, where he was sitting is where the trajectory of the bullet went to. I did a very non-scientific trajectory path of the bullet based off of where I was told he was sitting. I actually sat there myself with Erica in the chair, and it lines up perfectly with someone's left side of their head, where it went to and out of the top of their head and into the wall, up into the ceiling, into the attic. And I mean, we were even in the attic digging around.
What type of firearm was this, Jim?
243 bolt action rifle.
Okay.
And then, of course, Lori said they didn't think they could prove that the sled and the solicitor didn't think they could prove murder, but she thought because they have to prove malice, but she believed because he sat into the room for at least a minute or more, and then when he came out, told everybody that he had committed suicide, that Caden had committed suicide, that there is a indication of malice and trying to cover up and lie what actually happened.
Guilty mind is what it is.
At least you could go after manslaughter. Worst case, what is the other manslaughter? They're looking, well, maybe he could get, you know, if we don't get murder, maybe he could get 2 years. Well, listen, the family doesn't want him, you know, in life, prison, or, you know, death penalty, these type of thing. They just want accountability. That's what they're looking for. She's not going to be sitting there counting the years, although she may, but I doubt it. She wants accountability for her son's death, and no one has taken that accountability.
Yeah.
And she deserves that. I mean, she's such a strong woman. She broke down a lot. I broke down a lot at the protest. We talked. I talked. Lori talked. Seton Tucker was there from Impact of Influence. She took time out of her weekend with a girls' weekend. It was very complimentary of her coming down and taking time out of her personal time with some friends to come down and to that protest. So a lot of good things happened. Almost 80 people were there.
But Jim, in addition to 80 people there, between Lawyer Lori, who must have about a million followers on TikTok, and Seton has about 45, 50 followers on YouTube, which is a different audience and kind of a tougher audience, and then you have 100,000 on TikTok, you basically had almost a million people interested in this, and you have done content about this story that has generated millions and millions and millions of views.
Yeah, tens of millions of views. Hundreds of thousands of comments. So people are aware of this and are looking to help in any way they can. So,
well, at any rate, this needs to be investigated much, much farther.
And 100% agree.
And these folks, the family, deserves some kind of answers to what occurred, and not just have a closed case.
And I want to thank everybody that's brought attention to this, including Fitz News, the Clinton Chronicle, Fox Carolina, Seton Tucker, of course, Lori Murray, not only on her channel but helping the family out legally. There's so many people that are involved in getting this thing moving in the right direction, and I thank them from the family, and everybody is appreciative. And so, good job, everybody. Let's just keep that foot on the gas.
Yeah. And good job, you, Jim. You deserve a lot of credit for taking this story that was dead in the water, and you've given it life. And whatever the resolution is, you deserve a tremendous amount of credit here.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I get a lot of, a tremendous amount, I shouldn't say a lot, a tremendous amount of messages, emails, all these type of things. You know, please look into my family and this and this. And there's so many tragic stories out there. And this one just happened to hit me because, it was a 14-year-old boy. And I'm like, oh, where are you from? And Clinton, South Carolina. I'm like, geez, that's, you know, you're right here in our own state. Like, what? So, it was just one of those things that it just worked out. And I'm glad it did because... not only is he's innocent, never should be happened to, but you know, he's just sounds like he was a beautiful boy, and I never met him, but just through his family, you can just tell.
It does. I agree. Those pictures of him are very compelling, I think. So yeah. Tell us what else is going on with Mr. Miller. Well, actually, tell us a little bit about, tell us anything you can't, I understand there are things you can't disclose right now. So tell us what you can disclose about this lawsuit filed by Jane Doe that is anchored in her claim about repressed memory. And so she alleges that she was raped in 1998, but she repressed the memory and didn't regain the memory until, I think it was July of 2023. So tell us about, just take us through.
Yeah. There's a lot. I haven't even posted this story yet. There's some I'm probably not going to get into, although there's a lot into this filing, and it is, how many pages is this? It's 43 pages. And
the exhibits. The exhibits are probably another, 25 pages? Because one is about 10 and one is about 14.
Yeah. And you, of course, know, Elaine, that, you know, in a 43-page summons for a jury trial demand, that's just tip of the iceberg, you know.
Yes, it is.
These attorneys don't put everything.
My complaint up in New York, the first one was, gosh, I hate to even think, it's close to 200 pages. Even Brad Edwards' complaint, he had to file a complaint and an amended complaint, and combined, they were about 270 pages. So, yeah, it's these are tough, these are complicated issues, and they just trigger everybody to act. So let's go with it. Explain what happened and what you can say about what happened.
All right. Let me try to see if I can get this off the top of my head. So Jane Doe, number one, is alleging that in 1998, when she was 15 years old, she was sexually assaulted by John Paul Miller, Pastor John Paul Miller, who's now, I don't know, 40, in his mid-40s, something like that. And her attorney is saying that she's probably in her 40s now as well. Her attorney is saying that under, because you would think, well, statute of limitations certainly would have expired by now, because this isn't a criminal.
Yeah,
this is not a criminal case. This is a civil case. That she has to qualify to bring this particular case, she would have had to have what's called a repressed memory, which means that she took the memory of the alleged attack and just put it in the back of her mind and never thought about it again. And I'm sure I've got that wrong. If you have a better definition, please feel free to.
I do, but Jim, let's just go with it because it's essentially good enough. We can get Dr. Loftus on, but for the purpose of the audience, I think you're close enough. Let's just go with it because we're not picking that apart. We're not even arguing.
And how old was JP at the time of this attack?
He was 19.
19. So yeah. So right now that puts him at 44, 27 plus 19?
Yeah, I guess. No, he's 46.
All right, 46.
I can't do math. You can't do math.
Yeah, no. But, right, that puts him at 44.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's get back to this, that for her claim to survive, because the statute of limitations has told, that means it's expired, actually, in this case, she has to assert that she didn't remember, that she repressed the memory of the rape until she alleges that he assaulted her again in July of 2023. And that's when she remembered the previous rape. And that means that she has 3 years from 2023 to file the lawsuit. So this idea that she repressed it and then remembered it in 2023 is the only way she could file a civil action about this. Otherwise, her right to file expired either 3 years from the event or, what is it, when she's 27? Or it basically would have expired, because she was a minor when it happened, it would have expired in 2010. But either way, we're years past the expiration date for her filing this, unless she grounds the complaint in a claim that she repressed the memory of the rape. So take it from there, Jim.
All right, so let me explain the statute of limitations as it pertains to this particular case. So the 1998 alleged assault, it did take place before South Carolina passed what it's called a survivor-friendly statute in 2001. And that is 15-3555, and that was codified into law. But at the time of the alleged assault, and the childhood sexual abuse claims were subject to a very strict statute of limitations for not criminal, civil, right? It was 3 years. Or the victims were required to file lawsuits within 6 years after turning 21, which Elaine had just referred to and says by the age of 27. Or within 3 years of discovery of the injury was caused by abuse. That's called the discovery rule. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So, but that creates...
It's a discovery that you have a cause of action, basically.
Yeah, but that creates a critical problem, I think, for Jane Doe number one. Unless she can successfully invoke the discovery rule, the 1998 claim would be time barred under pre-2001 law. We're getting really complicated here.
We're with you.
Yeah, okay. But South Carolina's 2019 amendment, that eliminated the statute of limitations for childhood sexual abuse. But right now, it's unclear whether the courts will apply current law retroactively to pre-2001 cases, or Jane Doe's lawyers, I guess, hedge their bets by asserting repressed memory, which they are. And repressed memory, I could do a keyword search on the word repressed. It's throughout her whole complaint. And that would trigger the discovery rule and potentially save her claim if the court uses the pre-2001 law. But for the 2023 assault, now there's a second assault when she was an adult just 2 years ago. She's claiming there was a second assault.
Yes.
For the 2023 assault, the claim is timely, of course, under the South Carolina standard 3-year statute of limitations for personal injury, which is 15-3530. And so that aspect is legally vulnerable. But the credibility of both assaults is now linked, right? So that's a lot.
Wait, no, Jim, not necessarily. The 2023 assault, let's just alleged assault,
because it's kind of...
Alleged. And yeah, as a woman, I find it... I'm a little... I question a few aspects of it. It's kind of hard to believe some of it. But anyway, they're actually separate. So maybe she could just go forward with the 2023, and then hopefully she has medical records related to that, and she can claim pain and suffering, because in those medical records she now remembers or is re-traumatized by the 1998 claim. So maybe that's as viable. Yeah.
But I want to make it clear, I'm not here to say that I believe her or disbelieve her.
Right.
Her words are her words. I am not here to tear anything of her words apart. What I am purely looking at is the law in the state of South Carolina, and I'm applying it to her complaint. That's it. If this happened, and I'm not going to go and research this and go get quotes on it, it is an awful, awful thing to have happened. Not only once, but twice. But having said that, I'm looking at the law and applying it towards the complaint. That's all I'm doing. So, if this happened, I am with her.
The complaint had attached to it an affidavit from JP's mother and one from JP's first wife. And I found those compelling for different reasons. They're in the public domain. You can go to the Horry County Public Index and find them for yourself and read them for yourself so that, you know.
By the way, it's Horry County. The H is silent.
This is a complicated group of folks who aren't, when you think of a pastor and his father's a pastor and what you expect these families to be about, this is not, the claims made by John Paul's mother and John Paul's first wife, and those claims were made in another lawsuit. These are not affidavits that were generated for Jane Doe number one's lawsuit. They were filed in separate actions years ago. And, when you file an affidavit, that's sworn testimony. If what you're saying is false, the attorney that files your affidavit in a court of law could be subject to sanctions, because you cannot suborn perjured testimony, and the person that's making the false statement could be held accountable. It's the same as lying on the witness stand. You're making this statement under oath. So I took those two exhibits rather seriously. There is a can of worms here. So Jim, so when you're bringing this to light, are you getting, my understanding is there is a group of people on the internet that are heavily invested in a point of view about Micah Miller's death, and they seem to direct their interest at JP. And then I guess they also kind of come at you. So how's that going? Is that just more fun?
Well, yeah. So listen, I until February 16th, I had never met John Paul Miller ever in my life in person. John Paul Miller went out and he filed, 33, 34 different lawsuits. including restraining orders. So a combination of restraining orders and lawsuits. And I had stayed out of the whole Micah Miller, John Paul Miller thing because I think I originally did something about it. And then I saw the avalanche of everybody and their brother coming at it, and it just creates too much noise. I said, enough. I got more on my plate than I need with this. But what sparked my interest in all this was someone filing 35 lawsuits against people who were, he called, protesters. So that sparked my interest, and I said, well, I want to go see for myself what these protests are all about, and I want to see what this church is all about. I had even no idea that the church was closed, but the day I happened to go on February 16th, they were having church service at the church. And I found out online they had it at, 10:30. So I showed up at 10 o'clock. I parked on the side of the road, and I walked over, and I saw the protesters there. And I walked up to them. I think we talked about this in this one. And so I got their reaction, and 5 minutes after I was there, they stopped talking to me because they said I was pro-JP. I have no idea why they said that. I simply asked questions. And so I went to church, and everything was fine. But I asked questions, and I had a two-hour live interview with Micah Miller's family's attorney, attorney Regina Ward. She's an attorney out of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, mainly family court attorney. But we had a two-hour conversation, and she's a very nice person and a great attorney, and she's doing great things for the demonstrators and Micah's family. And she asked me, you know, why is everybody getting so mad at you? And we started talking about the way that I'm approaching this case, and I approach every case, is right down the middle. And I try to, you know, present both sides of what I see as facts for both sides, and I present those. What has happened in the J.P. Miller case, and John Paul Miller case, and Micah Miller, Micah Francis, whatever you want to call it, they all have different terms, is that all the media attention, including People Magazine and Newsweek and everybody else, has come down on John Paul Miller, just like they came down on Alec Murdoch and everybody else.
Yeah.
And it's clearly one-sided. Clearly one-sided. And there's always two sides to every story. I mean, isn't that the way of journalism? There's always two sides to every story. And that's all I do. So I'm not JP. I'm just a JP supporter. I am just out there giving the facts for both sides instead of just one and piling on to John Paul Miller. If I just wanted to do that, then I won't do it because I never do that. That's why Patrick Wilson talked to me. That's why Myra Crosby chose me for her book. That's why the J6 person chose me for my book, because I shoot straight. And even the attorney for Micah Miller's family, Regina Ward, said the same thing. She goes, your journalism is a breath of fresh air in what I've seen over the past 2 years or year.
It's why Frank and I love your, you know, why we've been doing this now, True Crime in the Lowcountry, for months. And you're a joy. And you are. You're right. You're unbiased, and you just cover the story and go where the facts lead. But you do something even more. You get out there and talk to the witnesses. You look at the original, you know, what is the story? What's possible? You go out and stand on the street and say, is this possible? Or you measure the distance, or you do whatever it is to truly investigate. You don't just sit behind a keyboard and rely on gossip. You're out there.
Boots on the ground.
Absolutely. Boots on the ground, tires on the road, gas in the tank, putting your effort into it. And I know Frank is upset, you know, just Frank and I are both really impressed by your coverage.
Yeah, and I get a lot of, you know, you're no journalist. Who do you think you are? I'm like, I'm no journalist. I just posted my 500th article on crimeandcast.com this last week. My 500th article. I've written 2 books. I've got a 3rd one in the works. I have my own podcast. I'm doing radio on 97.7 here as a talk show host about true crime in the Lowcountry. Like, what part of this don't you understand is journalism? Like, did I, you know, graduate from the University of Kansas with a journalism degree and get attacked by men? No. But that doesn't mean that I'm not.
Being attacked by a rabid gang of women, it's not a whole lot different than being attacked by men, I think. I don't know. But, Frank, you've often compared his CC News Network website to the Drudge Report, which at one point you really liked, right?
Oh, yeah. The Drudge of 2000, 2010, you know, before his death, you know?
Yeah.
Before the death of Breitbart, it was amazing. It was amazing. And Jim's website kind of mirrors that to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
I love the hell out of it. And you know, I got to tell you something. The snobbery, the effete snobbery of people saying that Jim is not. What was the claim, Jim? They said you're not a reporter.
Yeah. A journalist? Who do you think?
He's not a journalist. Okay, Jim is more of an investigative journalist than anyone I've ever met. All right.
Thank you.
I tell you why. Just because he doesn't travel around with a van with a Skylink on top, and four or five roadies that put up a pop up. Doesn't not make him a journalist, all right? Just that he doesn't have an affiliation with a local news station doesn't make him not a journalist. In the truest sense, I could see the founding fathers, the way that news was disseminated. Of course, Jim has the technology to submit news in seconds, but the investigative nature of Jim's work is centuries old and has been revered for centuries. So, Jim, I'm sure that you're not sensitive enough or insecure enough to be concerned about people saying this stuff. But it just tells you a whole bunch about where it's coming from, you know?
You know, Frank, that's what's missing. We don't have groupies. Now, on YouTube, I did a little bit. But you and I, we don't have groupies.
Oh, Elaine, I'm your groupie.
No, you're not.
I'm your groupie, Elaine.
I'm going to smack you for that. Okay, so listen. But Jim does have people. What was this, Jim? You had somebody that had, they get these Gmail accounts like, I hate Jim, or Jim is bad.
No. The groupie that Jim wants is, I throw my bra at you.
No, that died with Tom Jones.
All
but
right.
Listen, is Tom Jones still alive, by the way? We don't know.
Yeah,
Anyway, so Jim, no, tell us. So there was these five comments, these five different email accounts where people are saying, you suck and you're not a journalist. And you looked at the IPS address of all of the emails, and it was the same person. It was one person with five accounts, and they're all kind of poorly spelled or grammatically incorrect, but it's some version of that they hate you, and they're criticizing your journalism. But here's the thing. We do not, when we cover stories, regardless of whether we're the only news outlet covering it, because we've been doing a lot of original stuff on true crime in the Lowcountry, it just doesn't get the amplification that other platforms allow. But we don't chase after anybody. We're not doxing people or chasing them down or figuring out, what their home address is or where they work or who their family are so we can hound them. We're just simply reporting the news.
Stay with us on True Crime in the Lowcountry. We'll be right back after this short commercial break. Don't go away.